every single home game in the cup, and
I've got goose flesh. I've got bumps coming up all over me.
Yeah, well, that's the sort of, because I remember they were there watching me score down the road, and what we were all used to talk about every game. So that was like a moment, like the birth of your first child type of thing, you know.
John, let's do that book. Lovely to have you on. John Aldridge in our winner's enclosure.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The 5 Live News with Dina Campbell. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told the country's military to keep fighting with full force in Lebanon and Gaza in response to the ceasefire proposal put forward by 12 international allies. Mr. Netanyahu's office said this is an American-French proposal to which the Prime Minister did not even respond. Frank Gardner is the BBC's security correspondent.
Both sides have put themselves into a difficult position. Hezbollah has lost a lot of its fighters in the last few days. They are weakened. They have said we will only stop when there's a ceasefire in Gaza. 11 months of negotiations haven't produced that ceasefire, so it's hard to see that being achieved in 21 days, even if everyone agreed to stop for 21 days. So I'm fairly pessimistic right now.
The current managing director of Harrods has issued a statement accusing his former boss, Mohammed Al-Fayed, of presiding over a toxic culture of secrecy, intimidation, fear of repercussion and sexual misconduct. Mr. Ward says he wants to convey his personal horror at recent sexual allegations against the billionaire. One woman has told the BBC she was attacked when she was 16 after being made to have intrusive medical examinations arranged for her with Dr. Anne Coxon, who hasn't replied to the BBC's request for comment.
When I first started working for Mohammed Al-Fayed, he soon started asking me inappropriate questions, like, did I have a boyfriend? Had I been sexually active? Well, I was only 16 years old and I was a virgin, and he soon discovered that.
The Justice for Harrods Survivors Group has filed a complaint to the General Medical Council about the conduct of Dr. Anne Coxon. The COVID inquiry has been hearing from a former national clinical advisor at NHS England who visited around 40 intensive care units during the pandemic. Breaking down in tears, Professor Kevin Fong said the scale of death was very difficult to capture in the figures and said nurses told him they had patients raining from the sky. He said that despite best efforts, patients did not receive the standard of care that would be expected in a non-COVID period. New figures suggest the average cost of children's birthday parties now costs about £524. Parents say the days of a few rounds of pass the parcel, musical statues and a piece of cake to take home are long gone. Ellie Gibson co-hosts the podcast Scummy Mummies.
I don't know where anyone's getting that money, really, let alone what they're spending on. Are they icing the birthday cake with foie gras? Are they making the egg mayonnaise sandwich with Fabergé eggs? Because that is an astonishing amount of money, I think, to spend on a kid's party.
And time for sport with Shoji Osaka.
Good afternoon. The Manchester United boss, Erik ten Hag, concedes he will have to look in the mirror after his team's disappointing 1-1 home draw against the Dutch club Twente in the Europa League. United have endured a patchy start to the season with 3 wins, 3 draws and 2 defeats across all competitions. They are currently 11th in the Premier League table. There are 9 fixtures in the final round of the 2024 County Championship season starting today, although bad weather has delayed 8 of those matches. Currently, there's only play between Essex and Surrey at Chelmsford. You can follow the cricket on Sports Extra or through the BBC Sport website and app. And in tennis, the British number one, Jack Draper, is through to the last 16 at the Japan Open following a straight sets win over Mateo Bellucci. Draper will play the Polish second seed Hubert Hurkacz catch tomorrow.
On Radio 4, the more you listen, the more you see.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
A US presidential election is looming, but underneath, conspiracy culture rears its head once again. And nothing is as it seems.
All those things that we had feared our whole lives was coming true.
Burn the house down and start over. That seems to be the way.
It's America through the looking glass. Join me, Gabriel Gatehouse, as The Coming Storm continues. Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Adrian Childs.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
It's nearly 12:05, so I wish you a very good Thursday afternoon. We'll hear from an antiques dealer just after 12:30 who's fined £3,000 after her and her husband found a young man in the back of their van. They'd just come across the channel from France, and this young man had managed to get in the back of their van at some stage, though they called the police and the man was arrested. They still got this fine at their door a few months later, and she says in no uncertain terms that next time she would just let him out of the van and certainly wouldn't go to the police. But we'll look into what's come into play there a little bit later. Also speaking to the man behind a podcast called The English Disease, looking at football and hooliganism. He's one of the men on it, talking about why he thinks men got involved, not quite sure which tense we're using here, in match day violence.
If you haven't got that thing to risk, like, you might as well go and bash some people up on a weekend and have a laugh with your mates and get on it, because, you know, what's going to happen? You go down, right, you get 6 months. Well, what else are you going to be doing for 6 months? You know, and you, it gives you a little bit of, gives you a little bit of status, and it gives you a little bit of, like, belonging. So you might as well. What else are you going to do?
That's your nihilistic 26 seconds of the morning. Look forward to talking to the man behind that podcast a bit later. After one, Martin Lewis talking about mortgages. And in your Tell Us This Week, we want to know about what you did with your first pay packet. And we'll come to some of those in just a moment. Just one here. First pay packet, 1980, £24 for a week's work as an apprentice quantity surveyor. I was 16. I bought my mum a carriage clock. Oh, that's so sweet. And she'd wanted it for ages but couldn't justify the expenditure. She still has it today and she's now 88. David Hanna, then of East Kilbride, now of Winchmore Hill in North London. That is the nicest thing I've heard all morning by a country mile. If you want to get in touch, do so. Text 85058. Let's have a look about what the government is and isn't up to with Elon Musk. I'm now confused because I've heard Peter Kyle, amongst others, who's in government. I don't know exactly what his title is, but he's looking after the technological aspects of things. And he sounded a big fan of Elon Musk the other day, really jumped out the radio at me hearing him talking. And then we hear that Elon Musk has not been invited to a big sort of conference about tech stuff. Faisal Islam can flesh these meanderings of mine out for us here. So Faisal, what has he been not invited to?
Next month, 14th of October, is this new government's one of the key dates for them. You know, you'll remember that they're saying money's a bit tight. What do they need to do? They need to get lots of investment, not from borrowed money, but from the private sector, from international investors, in everything from hospitals to the future of tech to roads and everything, right?
Yeah.
But, and so they're having this international investment summit on October the 14th. Big cast list of all the top execs. Most countries do this. You know, Emmanuel Macron holds it at Versailles, and all the top execs from around the world, they turn up and they're charmed. And, you know, sometimes you get the royals out to charm them for a few more billions to kind of plough into the UK, open up factories and all that sort of stuff. Now, on the face of it, a perfect candidate to attend this would be the guy that runs the biggest electric vehicle company in the world, runs the biggest private space operator, runs a social media site that's got, you know, big ambitions on AI, and that would be Elon Musk, the richest man in the world. And so I've been sort of questioning, is he invited or not? Now, he was invited last year to the equivalent summit from the previous government, didn't actually attend, but did attend a different summit, the AI summit, where he was star of the show, fireside chat with, actually, I think he was interviewed.
Rishi Sunak.
He was interviewed by Rishi Sunak. That's Rishi right, Sunak, yeah. Taking on our role there. But he has not, my understanding, I had that confirmed yesterday, been invited to this summit. And privately, I've had it sort of pointed out to me that this would be very difficult to invite someone who had made a series of what was seen as inflammatory comments on his own social media site, as it was, during the riots last month. Now, if you remember, around that time, he used his own account, which is followed by hundreds of millions of people on X, which he also owns, formerly Twitter. He said that he sort of predicted that UK would be facing civil war. He reshared a post that was misinformation, which was a fake headline in a mocked-up Telegraph suggesting there'd be detainment camps in the Falkland Islands. And he sort of repeatedly attacked the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. And so, you know, that is the backdrop. At the time, these comments were called totally unjustifiable and pretty deplorable by ministers. And that is my understanding of why this invite was not forthcoming.
I mean, here's that clip I mentioned of Peter Kyle, Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology, referring to, you know, Elon Musk in the most glowing terms on the radio on Monday.
I would definitely sit on a stage with Elon Musk. I think what would be different, though, is the nature of the conversation that we'd have. The thing that surprised me was that he wasn't pushed at all on any of the statements he's made and some of the decisions he's made with Twitter. But, you know, when it comes to Elon Musk, you know, again, he is a remarkable inventor, a remarkable innovator, and a quite extraordinary business person that can capitalize and commercialize those innovations. And I give him credit for that.
So, I mean, somebody's not talking to somebody else, it seems, or I don't quite know what to make of it or where this is going to go. I mean, perhaps they're taking a view, look, we need him more than he needs us on this.
It's a very tricky balancing act, because when you're attracting international investment, you're bound to stretch across lines of ethics, because people with money often, you know, in foreign policy terms, they have, some of them have questionable human rights records. If you think about sovereign wealth funds in the Gulf, there are issues about foreign policy and whether that aligns with our foreign policy, all these sorts of things. But normally, you know, that tension is there the whole time. There will be a bunch of sovereign state, you know, Gulf states present and being wooed and charmed to try and invest in the UK at this summit in a couple of weeks' time. So these sorts of balancing acts are quite common. But I can just tell you one thing. I got contacted after I broke this story this morning by the former Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, who said, and this shows you the balancing act, he said when he had spoken to Mr. Musk, and haven't put this to Mr. Musk yet, at the end of last year, he said he was thinking about where to put his second European electric vehicle factory and battery factory, gigafactory as they call it. There's one in Germany. And that the UK would be a top candidate for that. So then that shows you how tricky the balancing act is. On the one hand, perhaps unthinkable, as some have pointed out, to have somebody who has talked about the UK in the way that he's talked about it, you know, coming to this conference. On the other hand, here's a guy who could seriously, incredibly, potentially open an EV factory, which is one of the industries of the future that we're supposed to be all focusing on. So a very, very tricky dilemma. And what's come out of this is, at the minute, he's not coming to this summit in a couple of weeks. Now, whether he chooses to accept any invitation is another question. And he's pushed back very hard against his snub, saying that people shouldn't come to the UK anyway because of...
I mean, he's still... I mean, you just aren't the world's richest man. I mean, he's right up there, even if he isn't the richest. But how can he still be the amount of money he spent? I mean, if you know, you'd think he wouldn't have much left after, you know, starting a space program and all the rest of it.
Yeah, but the wealth he has generated comes from the value of the companies he's built up. So the value in stock markets of Tesla and the value in stock markets of SpaceX has ballooned. He owns, I forget the precise proportions, a huge chunk of it. Twitter, on the other hand, X as it is now, has fallen in value because that has not, I mean, that wasn't, if you like, right now, turning out as the greatest business decision, and its popularity in the UK, according to polls, has come down. I mean, partly around maybe some of the things that happened in August. You know, if you like, it is very rare. This is, he's obviously a very rare person in the sense that he's a massive investor and business person who is also, if you like, part of quite a tempestuous culture war. And you know, he's also fallen out. You know, he's obviously clearly taken sides in the American election, huge backer of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And it has been said that over there, you know, he obviously probably backs many of Donald Trump's policies and thinks he'd make a great president. But he also fell out with the Biden administration over their approach to electric vehicles and other things. So, you know, he does turn up, though, at the equivalent conferences in other countries. Like, he was with President Macron at Versailles ahead of the Olympics, 3-hour lunch, I understand, with the world's biggest chief execs. So the question is, can you, should you look past everything that a chief exec like this says, because there might be an investment potential? Maybe they judge the investment potential is pretty small, actually. He has in the past said that he wasn't going to invest in an electric vehicle Tesla factory in the UK because of Brexit. So maybe it wasn't on the cards anyway.
But he's also got this geopolitical power, hasn't he? I mean, as I understand it, in some ways he's got the power in some areas of the world to turn the internet on and off.
Yes, with Starlink.
I mean, This is massive. This is
no, absolutely.
Many nations can.
Well, in many ways, he's a bit like a sort of prime minister or a president, but not of a country. You know, he does have that power. He does. You know, there are some interesting questions about his power to turn Starlink on and off in certain war zones.
Yeah.
Clearly, NASA uses him extensively in their future of the space race. So it's not as if, even with him having fallen out with elements of the Biden administration, that he hasn't got loads of government contracts in the US.
You've somehow got to do business with him, whether you like it or not,
well,
really.
Yes, but if, as some in government believe, some of what he said and his big audience contributed to inflaming tensions in August, you know, it's unthinkable to engage with that. Mm-hmm. That would be the argument. You can sort of understand both of them. Like, this is one of those situations where I'm glad that you and I are journalists and we don't have to make the call here. It is quite an, you know, I think people will have different views. You know, it's quite interesting. It's pretty much split 50-50. People are saying, well, good riddance to him. We shouldn't be kowtowing to people like that. He undermined our country. Others are saying he's a protector of free speech. It's insane to turn someone down that could possibly build a car factory. Yeah, you know, but then you have other, you know, the Chinese might want to build car factories in the UK. Are we going to say no to that if it might provide jobs? So these are the sorts of decisions you have to make when you're in government. You know, famously, Keir Starmer, leader of the opposition, boycotted the Qatar World Cup in 2022. You know, made a big thing of it. He's not doing things like that now. He's prime minister and wants loads of investment, and Qatar has one of the biggest sovereign wealth funds in the world. Yeah. So these are the compromises that you have to make. But what I've discovered at first glance on this issue, they've decided not to seek his favour at this particular summit.
Interesting. Faisal Islam, thank you. Thanks very much indeed. Nice talking to you. Thanks for coming on. Animal welfare campaigners are calling for a supermarket food labelling scheme to be dropped amid concerns about that basic farm standards aren't being met. RSPCA assured covers almost 4,000 farms. It's labelling. It's supposed to tell shoppers they are buying higher welfare meat, eggs, fish, and dairy. But activists say their undercover investigations found failings at around 40 farms. The RSPCA itself has sent in inspectors to carry out random spot checks on more than 200 farms to check welfare standards. Our rural affairs correspondent Malcolm Pryor joins us. So what's going on here?
Yeah, hi Adrian.
Hiya.
Basically, any of us who's browsed the aisles of your local supermarket is going to see these labels on burgers, fish, chicken, egg products. Now, they're supposed to reassure shoppers about the standards to which that food's been produced and to help them make an informed choice about what they buy. And one of the biggest labelling schemes is RSPCA Assured, set up 30 years ago with a promise that the farms it certifies would produce food using higher animal welfare standards, higher than the UK law expects. The whole system's based on assessments, inspections of the farms, making sure that they're looking after livestock to a level set out by the RSPCA's own welfare scientists. And that allows them to carry the label on their products that can be stocked in supermarkets from Aldi, Lidl, Sainsbury's, Tesco's and restaurants, including McDonald's.
So there's concern the scheme isn't working as it should be.
So
where's this come from?
Yeah, so earlier this year, there was a number of undercover investigations by animal welfare activists, and they say they found conditions on farms that actually fall below those basic legal standards. And that, they say, includes crowding, poor hygiene, unacceptable health conditions, and in extreme cases, they even got footage of what they say is physical abuse of livestock by farm workers. Now, all of that led to the RSPCA's own president, the TV one expert Chris Packham, to call for the scheme to be suspended. Now, today, an open letter signed by 60 organisations, vets, academics and celebrities, including Ricky Gervais, Joanna Lumley and Brian Adams, has been published calling for the scheme to be dropped completely. And that's because they say all it does is welfare wash animal cruelty and mislead the public.
And what is the RSPCA doing about it?
Well, look, it launched an immediate investigation after it was made aware of that secret filming footage. And it says it visited all the farms that were identified correctly as RSPCA-assured members. Now, in the end, that investigation saw two farms removed from the scheme completely. Five others were sanctioned in response to those concerns. But since then, the RSPCA has actually sent in its own inspectors for random spots at more than 200 farms as part of an ongoing huge review, comprehensive review of the scheme itself. Now, it says the findings of that review have yet to be published, but meanwhile, it has promised to take robust action, it says, against farms that it finds aren't delivering the standards shoppers think that the RSPCA assured labelling promises them.
Thank you very much, Malcolm Pryor, our Rural Affairs correspondent. This all comes as farmers have been protesting at what they call farm washing in some supermarkets. Guy Singh Watson, founder of Riverford, and a farmer in Devon. Thanks for coming on, Guy. Now, I take it this is when, I don't know, some chicken is labelled as, I don't know, higher welfare or, I don't know, it's probably not a good example, but there's sort of wholesome sounding words that don't necessarily mean anything. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, farm washing is the practice used by all our supermarkets to pretend through labelling and shelf labelling and so on that, and their own brands, that the food is coming from small UK family farms when the reality is it's coming from, you know, large mega farms and is often imported. You can go and buy, you know, Rose Dean fruit. Sounds like a nice, cosy British farm. But, you know, that fruit sometimes will come from the UK, but more often it will come from Egypt or Morocco or the Netherlands. And it's using emotive messages to put out a lie, really. And this is what we're calling farm washing.
So in terms of informing the consumer, what do we look out for? Because I take it you can't call something organic if it's not organic.
And
presumably that's not happening. But there are other phrases I often think, oh, well, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, over the last 12 months, we've seen a proliferation of claims, Lidl and Aldi, that they're investing billions in British farms. You know, if I go and buy a pint, I'm not investing in a brewery or a pub. I'm just buying a pint. And you know, they're just buying the produce from British farms. They're not investing in them. That is a deceit. It's a misuse of the. No, they are saying investing. They're not saying customers. So that is dishonest. And we need to see more honesty and transparency in our food chain so that we really know where the food is actually.
Okay, but they're using British suppliers then, which is something. Okay, they say investing.
Well, in the case of fruit, 15% of it is grown in this country and the rest imported. In the case of vegetables, about 50% and the rest is imported. So instead of having Union Jacks all over their shelves, it would be more appropriate to have a Spanish flag in winter, actually.
So again, as a consumer, what is the advice if we did, you know, if we don't want to be taken in by this, and also given that not everyone can afford sort of premium products, then help to inform us about how we should shop better.
Okay, so together with a number of other farmers, including Jimmy Doherty, we've produced a kind of mini-series of documentaries, which you can see at stopharmwashing.co.uk. You can write to your MP. You can lobby your supermarket. You can complain to the Advertising Standards Authority if you're feeling you're being duped. If there's, you know, a picture of a free-range chicken walking across a pasture when actually that chicken is kept in an intensive broiler house, that is misleading. And I think, you know, we're hoping that supermarkets can be embarrassed into honesty, but if they can't be embarrassed, then they need to be legislated against.
And often you do see the farmer's name on produce, be it in supermarkets. And from what you're saying,
Sorry, Adrian, can you give me an example? Because I don't think that is...
Well, I see it says sourced from such and such farm in Peterborough or something. But the point I'm making, it doesn't really help me because I don't know how big that farm is. You know, if I care about such things, is it some mega operation or is it, you know, is it somebody, you know, smaller and more careful and so on? You know,
we have bark codes. You know, we have the QR codes. It would be perfectly possible to put that into your phone and bring up that farm and see how it's producing food. But I'm sorry, I disagree with you, Adrian. I think you'll find it very rare to see a farmer's name on a product in a British supermarket because their business model is not to name the farm so they can buy from whoever they want and whoever can, you know, be a halfpenny cheaper that week, and that's how they've driven down the prices to British farmers below the cost of production, and that's why 61% of farmers fear they'll be out of business within 18 months, up from 49% last year.
Thanks very much indeed. Thanks very much for joining us. That's Guy Singh Watson from Riverford. Just gone 25 past 12. An interesting story. For an antiques dealer and her husband have been fined £3,000 by UK Border Force after they reported finding a stowaway in their van. Jane Cave and Ed Masters were on their way back from France in this country, got as far as Suffolk, when they heard noises in the back of the vehicle. On checking the van, a man jumped out and ran off, despite calling the police. Oh, the police did apprehend the man. The couple were told they were responsible and were fined for failing to properly secure the vehicle. Earlier, I spoke to Jane about what happened. I started asking her where she was when she realised there was somebody on board.
The Suffolk border. We're on the Eurostar, not the ferry.
Were you driving along or you stopped at some traffic light?
I was driving, yeah. Stopped because it was queued at the roundabout.
Okay, so with some trepidation, you went to the back of the van. Is it kind of a transit-type van?
Ed went to the back of the van and said, get out. And somebody's videoing us. And he got out, went to the garage across the road. So he stopped in the road.
So did you sort of apprehend him, or did you just call the police straight away?
Called the police. He was young, under 18.
And was he hostile in any way? Or?
No, not at all.
You thought you better call the police?
Yeah, and the police caught him.
And what did the police say to you? Did you get the sense you were in trouble then?
No, not really.
So when did you realise that you were going to be sort of fined for this?
June.
They just called you or you got a letter saying...
Got a letter saying £3,000. We've paid £100 a month.
And the offence you're guilty of is... failing to properly to secure your vehicle, so it was your...
Yeah, I think it's aimed at lorry drivers.
Yeah.
We've got the black tape. We don't have that. This is a transit van.
You'd caught somebody on the other side of the channel in the queue, hadn't you, trying to get into the back of the van and sent him packing. Was it the same person?
No, different person.
Right.
So the one we had obviously got in before.
Okay, so you think he was already in?
Yeah.
I mean, what could you have done to properly secure your van that you didn't? I mean, did it have a lock on the back of it?
It did, and so it was locked. It was locked until I got in. He got an email through, and he did it on my iPad in the van and unlocked it then, when he was in the front.
I mean, so what would your advice to people be?
Drop him as soon as you find out in a lay-by, and don't call the police.
Really? So if you had your time again, you'd just let him go and not risk...
He hadn't got home. We live in Norfolk. And, we wouldn't be fined.
And what would your advice be for people not to end up with somebody in the back of their van? I mean, would you secure it in a different way next time you went on a trip? And as antiques
dealers, I don't think we could. Not the transit van.
And you've taken the view that it's not worth the trouble contesting this fine. It cost you more in legal fees to do that.
Yeah.
Well, there is the woman Jane Cave who found this. Who found the stowaway in the van, reported it, and saw him arrested, but still paid a fine. So what's going on there? Bilal Barbro is from SAB Solicitors in Manchester. Bilal, what part of the law is at play here?
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me. It is very sad that, you know, what Jane and her husband had, you know, have to go through. But my first point would be that they should have appealed the fine. There was a 28-day period to object the fine, and the Home Office would consider, you know, whatever mitigating circumstances or evidence such a person would provide. And if the Home Office maintains that, you know, the fine is issued correctly, then such a person will have an opportunity to appeal to the court within the 28 days of the issue date of that objection to the fine. Now, I take it they didn't use these opportunities, and they've sort of ended up or, you know, committed themselves to make an arrangement that they should pay. So that is one thing for the listeners to understand. If they find themselves in a situation like this and they receive a fine for such an offense, they should consider appealing or at least making objection to the fine. Now, there is a lot for listeners or for people to understand, you know, when it comes to the laws around people, you know, coming to the UK illegally. Now, having said that, this is also very important to understand that these laws are not just applicable to the transport companies, to the hauliers, but they are applicable, these laws, to the drivers.
Okay.
And these drivers can be tourists as well. They can be, you know, company drivers, lorry drivers. So the law is not just specifically for people who commute or who transport regularly. It can be like you've gone, as in this case, we hear from Jane and Ed that they've only gone, you know, for a short trip, and then they've coming back. So they've ended up. So the laws are very, very strict. And if I can add, just, you know, for the benefit of listeners, that the fine can be up to £10,000 in some cases.
Yeah.
In this case, obviously, they are first-time offender. I mean, I'm sorry I have to use this word offender because they've sort of accepted, you know, the liability there. You know, they've been given the lowest sort of, you know, fine there. One other thing, the Home Office's guidance or advice is very, very clear that there are three simple principles for anybody who is travelling to the UK, you know, by road: to secure their vehicle, to check their vehicle, and then record the time of the checking throughout the journey. So, you know, they can use that as a mitigating argument. That
okay.
Look,
but it's a, to be honest, even having interviewed, I wasn't quite sure whether the back of the van was locked. I mean, if the van is locked and somebody manages to, I don't know, pick the lock and get in, then does that still fall on you? Okay, you should have made sure the lock was better.
Unfortunately, the second, as I gave you the three principles, that okay, you've secured according to your best abilities, but then obviously this is a long journey, so being a driver, you're taking breaks.
Yeah.
So the Home Office or the government, you know, the Home Office Department recommendation is that at each stop, the driver must check the vehicle again to ensure no unauthorized persons have entered the load or, you know, their vehicle.
Okay.
So this is where, you know, this sort of gray area is that, oh, is it still upon me that I've made sure my, you know, vehicle is secure? But then, so this is the issue.
Okay.
And then to when you do make these checks, you know, during the journey, the best practice is, and again, there is a checklist published by the Home Office. It's called Vehicle Checklist. It's available in public domain, and for the benefit of listeners, they can simply Google it, and there is basically like a form, and it asks you for the timing and where you've stopped and what checks have you made. So if anything goes wrong when you enter the UK and you find yourself in that situation, you can produce these to, you know, the officers, so, you know, you may get away with a fine.
Okay, thank you very much. That's Bill Baba from SAB Solicitors in Manchester. Just got 12:30. Let's get the news and sport.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The 5 Live News with Dina Campbell. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told the country's military to keep fighting with full force in Lebanon and Gaza. Mr. Netanyahu's office says a ceasefire plan put forward by international allies is an American-French proposal, to which the Prime Minister did not even respond. The current managing director of Harrods has issued a statement accusing his former boss, Mohammed Al-Fayed, of presiding over a toxic culture of secrecy, intimidation, fear of repercussion and sexual misconduct. Michael Ward says he wants to convey his personal horror at recent allegations made about the late billionaire. An 18-year-old is due to appear in court, charged with the murder of a 15-year-old boy in Woolwich in southeast London. Jacob Loshevich from Abbey Wood is accused of killing Dejon Campbell, who was found with stab wounds on Sunday. President Biden has announced that he's releasing nearly $8 billion of assistance for Ukraine ahead of a meeting with President Zelensky in Washington later today. In a statement, Mr. Biden said all the remaining security funds that had been earmarked for Ukraine will be released by the end of his term. Shoja Sharka's got your sport.
Thank you. Bad weather is playing havoc with the schedule for the final round of fixtures in cricket's county championship. 9 fixtures due to start today with all 18 teams in action, but only 2 have got underway. There are still a couple of promotion and relegation issues to be settled. You can follow the cricket on Sports Extra or through the BBC Sport website and app. There are 2 British sides in the Europa League playing this evening. Tottenham host the Azerbaijani club Karabag at 8 p.m. Manager Ange Postecoglou has been asked about one of the football topics of this week, the so-called dark arts, whereby teams resort to tactical fouls to slow the game down or time waste as much as they can get away with.
You're making it sound as if it's good versus evil, like, you know, Batman versus whoever, I don't know. God. Look, I think it's all part of the game, and it's always existed. It's just, you know, I don't believe in the dark arts. I don't know how to do it. It's just not in my makeup, but I've seen it be very effective.
Rangers also start their Europa League campaign tonight. They're away at Malmo at 5:45. Manager Philippe Clement has reaffirmed his long-term commitment to Rangers. It's after the former Belgium international Nordin Djebari suggested managerless Anderlecht should attempt to appoint the Ibrox boss, who's signed a new contract only last month. Well, Clement has made his position clear.
I engaged myself long-term for Rangers last month. Whatever team comes, I'm not going to go away. I love the city, I love the club, I love the dynamic at Ibrox with the fans, so I'm here to stay.
Arsenal women will be without Leah Williamson later as they look to turn around their Champions League qualifier against Häcken and reach the group stage. Williamson was absent due to concussion protocol on Sunday as Jonas Eidevall's side opened up their WSL campaign with a 2-2 draw against Manchester City at the Emirates Stadium. Eidevall says his side have enough experience to deal with the loss of the England defender.
I think it's one of the great things with the team that we have a lot of big game players. We have so many experiences and qualities. Leah, she's a fantastic player and she will be missed by any team that she doesn't play for. But we have enough quality and enough experience to take us through.
Elsewhere in Women's Champions League qualifying, Manchester City are 5-0 up, heading into the second leg against Paris FC. There's a huge night ahead for the Scottish champion Celtic. They're hoping to reach the group stage for the first time in the Women's Champions League. They hold a 1-0 lead going into the second leg against Ukrainian champions Vorskla Poltava. And in tennis, Britain's Jack Draper is through to the last 16 of the Japan Open. That's after a straight sets win over Mattia Bellucci. The world number 20, Draper, beat the Italian 6-4, 6-2, which was his first victory since defeat to Jannik Sinner in the US Open semi-finals earlier this month. And that is your latest from BBC Sport.
Matt Shawley.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
We are looking for a member of Matt's Parliament for New Forest East. Mick has got a claim. Hello, Mick.
In 1997, I proposed in a little hotel. I was actually in the bathroom.
What?
We were getting ready for dinner and I wanted it all to be sort of sorted before we went in and celebrated.
Listen, Andy, it's such a safe culture major as well.
We're toughening up the system to make sure that people who are unfit owners can't become football club owners.
Matt Shawley.
Monday to Friday from 2
on BBC Radio 5 Live. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
Adrian Childs. Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's nearly 20 to 1 and we need to look at a story, the details of which are undeniably distressing. We're getting close to the anniversary of the October 7th attack last year. More than 1,200 people died. Well over 200 others were taken hostage when Hamas gunmen crossed the border from Gaza, killing indiscriminately. They attacked dozens of sites, including kibbutzes, army bases and the Nova Music Festival, attended by 3,500 young people, hundreds of whom were murdered. BBC Storyville has been speaking to some of those who survived, piecing together what happened using footage from that day, including some filmed by Hamas.
A group of people jump out, screaming in Arabic.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
There was a really big explosion, and I flew back. Someone flew on me. And when I finally got up, they came back in. And then they started shooting everyone inside.
Yarif Moza is the director of the documentary. Yarif, just I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. Just explain how it works. What's the purpose of the documentary and what does it show?
Well, very closely to what happened on the 7th of October, I've received the permission to be on the site. So 2 days after the massacre, I was one of the first ones to see it in my own eyes, and the remains of the massacre untouched. It was horrible to see, and it was the starting point of doing a documentary, interviewing the survivors, collecting footage from them, but at the same time also putting my hands on footage captured by Hamas terrorists that came to the Nova Music Festival and slaughtered people viciously. So the film is, in my perception, it's the truth and evidence to exactly what happened on the 7th of October, with no narration, no interpretation, no commentary. It's only the survivors themselves, minute by minute, describing what happened to them.
And Ben is one of the survivors who features in the film, is with us in the studio too. Ben, I'm hesitate to get you to relive what happened to you in too much detail, but what took you to the festival? And if you sketch out what did happen to you?
Well, what happened to me is a big question, but I remember I was just back from my big trip in South America, 1 year and a half, 2 days before the Nova Festival, and I just landing. No one know that I'm in the country, just my parents, a little of my friends. And 6:30 came, and all the rockets came with this time, and the terrorists and everything. And we're running about our life. It was 16 kilometers that it was really hot. A lot of people, a lot of people behind. And I just remember that I get inside to something, to some feeling that I understand and feel it when I was in the military. I was so straight, get forward, running about my life, and with Moran and every friends that I be with me.
Tell me about Moran.
So Moran, actually, I didn't know her. I just met her under the tree, and I remember just I get my foot on the ground after I driving in my car, and I get two bullets very near to my foot and jump aside to some tree, and I realized that she with me. And it was there, I think, 30 minutes. I don't remember. 30 seconds. I don't remember exactly how much time, but it was, it felt so a lot of time. And I complete with the death over there. And I realized that maybe we're gonna die here. And there's some record and video that I picture there, but Murane told me she had three kids and she had a husband. And there I realized that it's not just a person. This is a person with a family, with people behind. If she's going to die, her kids, they didn't have a mother mm-hmm. after this. So I just take her with me all the way, and we did it together.
And you both managed to survive.
Yes.
And in choosing the footage, Yarif, I mean, it must be difficult to know where to draw the line into how, what you can use and what you can't use, because you want to make it clear how awful it was, but then you have to protect the dignity of the victims and survivors. And also, if you just put all the bad stuff out, then it loses its capacity to shock in itself.
So there was this tension, I must say, between me and commissioning editor Lucy Cohn from Storyville, that she was on the side of thinking about the viewers and broadcasting television and what we can show and what we cannot. And I was on the side of this is the truth, and we need to keep it as visible as possible so the audience will be aware of the cruelty of Hamas and what they did and how awful and terrible it was. And to, you know, so the viewers will understand what terror looks like. And it was this tension that we were during the whole process of the film, the editing, and we met somewhere in between, I must say. And I think it's a good thing. I think that eventually this film can be shown to wider audiences around the world, here, the BBC, Paramount Plus in the US, and people are capable of watching it and at the same time to judge the atrocities that Hamas did.
Ben, as I suppose, as you got away, you couldn't have immediately known the extent of what had happened and what you'd managed to survive. When did that become clear to you, the number of people killed and taken hostage and so on?
I think this is a very good question. When I realize that something happened and I take my car and driving as fast as I can, I just hear some bullets. I hear some people scream. There is a lot of terrorists behind them and they want to kill us. And I thought, you know, I live in the south. In the south, like I said, I hear some rockets sometimes. I go to the shelter. I don't panic in these situations. But when I realized there is terrorists that came to kill us, and I hear the bullets above my head, three bullets, I realized there is some terrorists. Some people, like three, four, five, I don't know, remember how much. But just when I get to the closest place, it's called Patish. That I realized from the people that there is thousands of terrorists. I thought when I running, there is 10, 20 maximum. But just after that, I realized how many.
Okay. And then presumably you got news reports and so on and realized what had happened.
Yeah.
And it might, I just wonder, I don't know, they talk about something called survivor guilt when you've escaped and others haven't. And I just, I mean, how difficult it must be. I mean, it's a year on, but you know, many more years will pass and it'll still be with you, I suppose.
Yeah, it's catch everybody in, from the Nova Festival. It's really hard to think about it. No one understands what we've been through when we think about it. But yeah, this is the situation. We think a lot about the death people and what they've been through and why they deserve to die and why we deserve to live. And it's hard to think about it. But like I said all the time, I see and I must to see the positive way and not to get inside this. It's really, really, really hard to talk about it. But we try to do our best if it's to be here and speak about it. And that's all, yeah.
Listen, thank you very much for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I was going to say, I look forward to seeing it. That's not the quite word, not quite the right word, but I will watch it and salute you for your work. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you very much
for coming on. Storyville, We Will Dance Again is on tonight at 9 PM on BBC Two and on the iPlayer. It's just getting towards 10 to 1. A new podcast series is out this week, looking at, well, it's called The English Disease, and it's looking at football hooliganism, and it's written and presented by a football writer called Sam Diss. And Sam joins us. How you doing, Sam?
I'm good, thanks, mate. How you doing?
Yes, good. Can I ask you a question? I mean, this obviously only it's not out yet, so I've only listened to the first one. I just wonder how much you go into the history of it, and I just went, when did it start in earnest? I was looking at some footage of a match in 1968, a big match, and the crowds were obviously still not segregated, and, you know, some were celebrating, some weren't where there was a goal. I thought, well, there can't have been, this was a FA Cup semi-final, and there can't have been much hooliganism at the time, or they would have been segregated. What is it? 1971, did it suddenly start, or when?
It's weird. There's not really any one agreed starting point. I think it's like, it's also been something that as long as there's been sport, there has been some degree of violence around it with spectators. Like, you know, if you go back to ancient Greece, there is trouble in Colosseums. And I think that if you look at what we call like football hooliganism now, or the phenomena of that, I think it really starts around, you know, in this post-war time, you've got this like real rise of youth subculture, and you've got a lot of kids who have now got a little bit of money in the back pocket who are starting to go to matches, and you start to see what becomes like this more modern version of what we would call hooliganism. And that really rises through the 1950s into the 60s, and going into the 1966 World Cup final and the World Cup in general held in England, police were like pulling their hair out, expecting there to be this huge surge in hooliganism. And it didn't arise. But what did happen as we move through the sort of like the counterculture of the 60s into the 70s, and then you've got deindustrialization, you then get this huge wave of disaffected youth, working class men mostly, who see football violence as a way of airing frustration, really.
But okay, we talk about industrialisation, but that had been going on for some time. I mean, why would the youth of the 70s be any angrier and in need of expressing themselves in violence than those in the 50s, say, and the early 60s?
Well, I think you've got, obviously, in the 50s and early 60s, you've got this real post-war landscape where there's a still real figuring out process of what these subcultures really look and feel like. And you've got things like the mods and the rockers. And I think that really what turns football hooliganism, you know, as this sort of like loose, weird phenomena into what we kind of see it today, or what we saw it in its heyday, certainly, was this kind of moral panic that was created around mods and rockers by newspapers, and sort of the sensationalism that come around that. And then all of a sudden you've got this idea that youth culture equals violence. And there's only so many times that you hear that before you start to truly believe it and start to enact that as well. That's what the literature says, and that's what the people who are the experts on it say. And we do go into some of that in the show, but I think that what we really try to focus on, as much as sort of like the legacy effects and the history of hooliganism, is more sort of like what it's mutated into today, and I guess sort of how it leaves this like lasting legacy on how a lot of English people see Englishness and see football and how they deal with class.
Right at the opening of the first episode, there's a clip of a friend of yours, right? And literally the first thing you hear is somebody you're calling Jack, who's been involved in match day violence in his time. His take about why men do it.
If you haven't got that thing to risk, like, you might as well go and bash some people up on a weekend and have a laugh with your mates and get on it, because, you know, what's going to happen? You go down, right, you get 6 months. Well, what else are you going to be doing for 6 months? You know, and you, it gives you a little bit of, gives you a little bit of status, and it gives you a little bit of, like, yeah, belonging. So you might as well. What else are you going to do?
I mean, it's just a truly dark clip, and I'm kind of, you know, I can see the sort of dark logic of what he's saying, but, I mean, there's lots of other things you can do, aren't there? You know, I don't know quite where I stand with it. You know, it's like, if you're working class, your life is that bleak, then going out and having a fight is about as good as it gets. I mean, it's not that bad, is it?
Well, look, I grew up in a council estate in the East End. I never got involved in football violence. Mm. You know, I think it is really sort of like your interpretation of the pressures that are around you. And, you know, we do become the sum of our influences, and the influences are mostly the people that we grow up with. I think that one thing that we really saw when making this was this real sliding doors moment where you have people that didn't get involved in football violence because of the people that they were around. That wasn't something that interested them. They moved into, you know, music or whatever else. And then you've got a lot of people where it only kind of takes this one person to act as this instigating figure. And then it turns something which is, you know, pretty universal, football. And then it adds this extra element on top of that, which, you know, universally, every single person that we've spoken to has spoken about this rush. And there's almost like an addiction to this rush. And you do get this weird kind of like primal magnetism to violence, which is not me condoning it in any way, shape or form, but there's clearly this adrenaline hit that happens, and then you're getting that in this ritualized fashion where this is happening every single week. You have access to this, and if you do have an environment where, you know, there's not a lot else going on, your prospects are perhaps not the sharpest and the shiniest, you've got this thing that you can look forward to on a Saturday, which then becomes a way for you to vent frustration with all of your mates. And it becomes a way of self-identifying, way of finding belonging in, you know, what we could call a very warped fashion, of course, mm-hmm. because not everyone who comes from that background finds that. But I think what I really wanted to do with this series was approach it with some empathy in a way that I hadn't really seen previously, and really look at the causes of why stuff like this happens, rather than just focusing on the effects.
And when, you know, I'm like you as well, I'm sure, see groups every Saturday or Sunday at football, you've got quite young kids, actually, make a lot of noise, but you look at them, they're very young. They're plainly wired. And I think it's more about sort of cocaine than alcohol these days. And, you know, most of them are daft and not dangerous, but it does spill over. And, you know, when I see that, where are they in the family tree? Are they direct descendants from the kind of people you've been talking to who are very active in the 70s? Or is it a different kind of thing now?
I think, you know, it just evolves. Like, every single subculture, it turns into something else eventually. I think inevitably, with the way that football changes and the way that society changes, you know, there's a lot of very easy access to drugs like cocaine now. And the prices of it are, you know, relatively accessible, and it doesn't take very much of it to do the trick. So I'm not surprised that it proliferates through big groups of lads. That's, again, not me condoning it in any way, shape or form. But I think it does become one of these things where, you know, they are descendants. I think that's a good word to use, because it has changed into something completely different now. The camaraderie is still there. But the gentrification project of football, which, you know, is kind of undoubted now, has turned into this thing where it's like you people are over-identify with football, and maybe perhaps they always have, but you've got like this access to all of these echo chambers on social where, you know, people see TikTok or something like that and think it's probably just a social channel filled with cat videos and people doing silly dances. But there's video after video after video of football violence, of football-related violence, of people from X firm offering out that firm. And that sort of stuff really does trickle down into the way that young boys and young men who haven't had a chance to identify through work or through other social means can really look to create an identity for themselves.
But surely the challenge is to find alternative ways,
of course,
to create an identity. I mean, for a long time, the police thought through the use of informants, as I understood it, mm-hmm. now, this highly organised sort of form of football hooliganism, you know, a green meeting for fights and so on. The police sort of manages not stamp it out, but get a grip on that. But then I think it's evolved through socials into something else now, as you said. They're sort of getting round that.
Absolutely. And, you know, we kind of covered this a little bit in the first episode. You know, I think that people think of, like, these marauding mobs, as I think Jack said, of, like, 80, 100 people. And in reality, it's more like groups of 8 and 10, and that's far harder to police. And they're not gathering at football. You know, you've got fewer and fewer of these people who are actually even involved in football at all, and they just kind of use football subculture as this kind of organizing principle to get people together. And you've got X firm, you've got Y firm, I'm from here, you're from there, and it's all just tribalism in its most, like, very obvious form. And that's kind of like what we're exploring in the show.
Okay, well done, thanks very much, Sam. The first two episodes of The English Disease are available on the 1st of October, wherever you get your podcasts. Martin Lewis coming up next between now and 2 o'clock.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The 5 Live News with Dina Campbell. The BBC has been told that one of the prisoners wrongly let out of jail under the government's early release scheme has been charged with sexual assault. 31-year-old Amari Ward was incorrectly released under the policy, which aims to ease prison overcrowding. The current managing director of Harrods has apologised for what he described as a shameful period under its former owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed, who's been at the centre of sexual assault allegations. Michael Ward, who worked with the late billionaire for 4 years, said he was not aware of any criminality and abuse. 5 women have told the BBC they were raped by Mr. Al-Fayed, who died last year at the age of 94. Our reporter, Louisa Pilbeam, has been reading Mr. Ward's statement.
A toxic culture, he talks of secrecy, intimidation, fear of repercussion and sexual misconduct. And he talks of his personal horror, that is a very strong word, of what happened in terms of these allegations. He says that he had no knowledge of any of these allegations, either by the police, the CPS or any internal channels. He is distancing himself and saying there was nothing he could do before this stage.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told the country's military to keep fighting with full force in Lebanon and Gaza, despite pressure to accept a ceasefire proposal. His office said the idea has been put forward by America and France and that he hadn't responded to it. The BBC has been told that the cybersecurity incident that saw public Wi-Fi closed at several of Network Rail's managed train stations was triggered by unauthorised changes to the network's landing page by a legitimate administrator account. Tellent, who are the third-party supplier of public Wi-Fi at nearly all Network Rail managed stations, said the actions have been attributed to an account with genuine administrator access at their internet provider, Global Reach. President Biden says the US will supply Ukraine with a type of long-range glide bomb as he released nearly $8 billion of military assistance for the